This is Retro Asylum, the UK's number one retro gaming podcast show.
Welcome to the UK's number one retro gaming podcast. This is Retro Asylum with me, Matt Denaris, and Damien. And this is episode number 31. How are you, Damien?
I'm very well, thanks, Matt. Very well indeed.
Excellent stuff. So Damien was introduced on one of the community podcasts a little while back as In Danger Mice. He's on the forums, got his own website, etc. He's now a fully fledged member of the team, I do believe. So we're taking over the podcast for this episode and going to give you a bit of what we like. So on this show, what we thought we would do is bring up two platforms that are pretty, maybe not underrated, but underthought of, I think is the right way to put it, isn't Damien?
I think that's absolutely right. They're two platforms that you almost certainly would have heard of, but you not necessarily have even used one. And so we think they're too good to miss, really. So this is why we're going to talk about them today.
Absolutely, yeah. And one being a computer and one being a console. So it's a nice little mix there of different types of platforms. So first up, we'll talk about what we've been up to. So Damien, what have you been doing?
Well, I've been up to my neck, actually, mainly in doing this retro asylum site redesign. But in between doing that, I've been playing quite a lot of games on my Commodore 64, and the reason for that is because I got the SD to IEC converter.
Brilliant.
Which basically allows you to plug an SD card into a little device that hooks up and pretends to be a Commodore 64 disk drive, which is great because you can put all your games onto there and start playing them all over again. And they're much more reliable than tapes. They're quite slow because Commodore 64 disk drive isn't very fast. But I've been playing a lot of Commodore 64 games. I've been playing R-Type. I actually got addicted to Trolley Wally. I don't know if anyone remembers
that
game.
Was that the Mastertronic game?
The most fantastic soundtrack from, I think it was Jean-Michel Jarre, his Equinox soundtrack. It's absolutely amazing. And so I've been doing a lot of that, really.
Brilliant stuff. Yeah, I got, like I was saying to you beforehand, I've got one of those SD card readers myself, the Commodore 64. Unfortunately, the one I got isn't quite as compatible as what I think yours is. So some of the games I like, anything with a fast loader on it, it just seems to throw a bit of a hissy fit and not load them up. Bit annoying. It's going back. The guy has very kindly offered to refund it for me. And I'm looking to possibly get your SD to IEC card or the 1541 Ultimate, because I believe the compatibility is much better on those.
Yeah, the 1541 Ultimate is actually one of the ones that I really looked at. I was very, very tempted by it because it is actually in every way better than the ST2 IEC. The thing is, it is a little bit more expensive. I think we were talking about this earlier because I actually thought it was quite a lot more expensive than it actually is now. It's about £100, isn't it, Matt?
I think it was something about €130, which translates approximately to about £100. Need to look into that a little bit more because there's obviously going to be some shipping costs in there as well. So, yeah, but it is very nice to play on the real machine again. I mean, I'm a big fan of emulation right across the board, but because of, I think it's more to do with monitor refresh rates on things like the Amiga and the Commodore 64, where smooth scrolling was very much what was the charm of the computer. It made everything feel very slick. You don't get that on emulation, whereas playing on the real machines, you get that smooth scrolling. I think having the SD card plugged into a Commodore, brilliant, because you can go back to all those games and they just feel almost chunkier on the real thing, don't they?
Yeah, it's really nice. I mean, you're absolutely right about the refresh rates. It's getting a bit better now, actually, to be honest, because LCD panels, I mean, they don't really run at a refresh rate at all, but the equivalent is about 60 hertz or 59 hertz, which is pretty much in line with NTSC. Of course, with power, we're still a bit screwed because we need something that runs at 50 hertz, and 50 divided by 60 isn't a very nice round number. So, again, you always have to make compromises. And also, emulation sometimes is a little bit sort of jerky because your computer will suddenly start to do something in the background. I know mine's done this. I've been in the middle of a game and all of a sudden it starts to do some defragmentation or virus scan or something stupid like that. And the entire game, you know, just messes up at the moment that you get killed. So it's much nicer in that way to run it on the original machine, because it won't defragment. Well, I've never seen a Commodore 64 on Amstrad do that yet.
Let's hope they never do either. But yeah, I think the SD cards, they're great. There's pretty much every old machine, old computer now, well, not pretty much, but a large majority of them have SD card readers for them now, which is, it's fantastic. People are developing these things still, and it gives us the gamer and you know, the hacker much better access to those machines, makes them feel much more modern. And that's something we'll touch upon on these on the two platforms we're going to come on to later. But so anything else you've been up to?
Well, apart from the site redesign, not a huge amount. I was hoping to do some more work on my Starquake remake, but in the sort of post-Christmas rush, I just haven't been able to do anything on it at all. I've also wanted to write a few reviews on my website, which one of them will be the SE2 IEC controller, so you'll be able to hear my experience with that, which is actually quite a bit better than Matt's. But I'll also be able to reveal a few things that can actually make the games a bit more compatible. And there's a number of things that the guy that I bought the unit off, he's actually produced an archive of pretty much all the really popular Commodore 64 games. So you'll find sort of Auf Wiedersehen Monty in there, your Monty on the Run, all sorts of things, Thing on the Spring. And they've all been set up so they will run off the SE to IEC straight away. And I think he's avoided fast loads, or at least he's only used compatible ones. And with the C64, there's so many disk images of the same game that have been cracked and hacked by various people that it is actually perfectly possible to find one that will work on it. It just takes a bit of time, but the guy's done all the work for you. It's brilliant.
Brilliant.
Just on the SD card, you're ready to go.
I'm certainly looking forward to seeing that site as well, because that's one of my main things about it. I want something that's very compatible. So, excellent. Well, I look forward to seeing that review as well. Myself, I have actually been playing on the Arcos gamepad. Now, this is a handheld emulation device running Android, and I'm going to do a little review of this on the retroasylum.com website coming in the future. So I've been playing around on that, testing the emulators out and just feeling what the device is like. And, you know, just to give you a little bit of a teaser, I'm a little bit disappointed with it, which is a big shame. So, you know, coming from a company like Arcos, which is, they're fairly well recognized, they've been around for a long time, they certainly make better devices than a lot of these Chinese companies that make these Android type platforms that you can play emulation and games on. So it is disappointing it's not turned out to be quite what I expected, but it's an enjoyable platform, but not quite what I was expecting. So a bit of a shame there.
Yeah, I think it's unfortunately, we at work had a number of Arcos devices in the past. They were sort of multimedia systems that could play video and stuff, quite a long time before sort of iPads and stuff were out that could do this very easily. And always for us, the Arcos is, were very beautifully designed, but they just slightly missed the mark each time, and it seems that they've done this again. It's a pity, but it seems to be a sort of common thing that they've managed to do.
Yeah, I think that the battery life is the worst thing on it. You can get 2 hours out of it maximum when you're playing a game, which is pretty appalling in all due respect to them. It's a 7-inch it's a 7-inch screen on it, and it's got a bit of a larger casing and chassis on it because of the controls, so you could surely expect to fit a larger battery into that size of a device. So bit of a shame, I have to say, bit of a shame. But outside of that, I've been playing Frontier Elite 2 quite a bit, and I mentioned this in the Best Of podcast that I found some videos on YouTube by Jim Plays Games, and I'll send a shout out to Jim. He's going to mention us on his blog and so on. Did some great videos on Frontier and how to get into it, and I've been playing that a lot. And because I've been slowly getting into astronomy a little bit more again, one of the lovely geeky things I like, it's nice to go to places that you've heard of, because in Frontier it's got the Milky Way as it was in 1993, and the Milky Way hasn't changed, but we've obviously found a lot more galaxies out there since 1993. So it's really interesting flying out to these places you've heard of or seen on star maps, and suddenly you're in that solar system. Obviously the systems within inside those galaxies are nothing like what it probably is. We don't know, do we? There's a whole wide more than a world out there to discover yet, isn't there?
Absolutely. I mean, I remember playing Elite originally on the BBC Micro, which we had at school, and it was just an absolutely fabulous game. I never really played Frontier. I remember it coming out on the Amiga, and I seem to remember from that it had quite a few bugs and issues when it first came out, which on the PC version was absolutely fine. You just get it patched. But yeah, I remember being a furore, you know, when it first came out, and people, and I think they didn't really put me off, I just never really got around to playing it, but I know it put a lot of friends off at the time.
Yeah, I think you're right there. I'm sure there might have been an update released on the front of, say, Amiga format or CU Amiga, because I know certainly Sensible Software did that with Sensible Soccer. There was version 1.1 come out on the cover disc of CU Amiga. So I'm sure there was some kind of patch, but I'm playing the CD32 version. So there's a version floating around on the internet that's from the CD32. It's had the copy protection removed and it's got the bugs removed and so on, so it's a bit of a fuller game. There was actually a small follow-up to it. I did say in the last podcast there was only three elites, but there was actually four, because there was Frontier, the First Encounters, I believe, which was a follow-on from Frontier, which added in some more missions and such like. I've not really looked into that myself, but it'd be quite interesting to see what that's like. Definitely.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I remember something about that as well. Just out of interest, I mean, are you playing this on a CD32, or are you playing it on an Amiga 1200?
No, I'm not playing it on either. I'm playing it on emulation.
So I emulated it. The reason I'm just going to mention this very quickly is because we were talking about SD solutions earlier, and I don't know how many people have put an SD card in their Amiga. I've got a 1200, and because of the IDE interface, it's very easy to do.
Yes, done it myself.
And there's actually a fantastic utility, if you do want to go down this road, called WHD Load. I'll put a link to it up on the forum, but basically what it allows you to do is to run any Amiga floppy on a hard drive, which those of you who had an Amiga know that it's very hard because of the copy protection on the discs to actually install them on the hard drive. In fact, it's almost impossible, but these guys, they're amazing. They've written this piece of software that can emulate all the versions of Kickstart, and they wrap all these games, essentially. So you've got the original games disc, they do something very special in code. I'm not too sure exactly how they do it, but they, on the original Amiga 1200, they emulate the Kickstart and then load up the disk into a separate area of memory. It's very, very clever. But
it is, yeah.
As an SD card solution, it's perfect. So you can have all your Amiga games on the SD card and just play them, you know, one after another. It's brilliant.
Yeah, I like that myself. I've got a 1200 with one of those in it, and it really is fantastic. And WHD Load's only about £15 to register as well, which is a bargain for what you're getting. So, and a lot of those installers for WHD Load are done... Well, not a lot of them. Some of them are done by the old crackers from the Amiga days, like Galahad from Fairlight and so on. So there's a lot of people still with their toe dipped in the Amiga world, which is really nice to see. I just love the fact these old platforms are still almost relevant now, because people are doing so much in the background. It's fantastic, I think. Absolutely fantastic. What else have I been up to? Well, not a lot more. I've just been playing a lot of games on the gamepad and Frontier, and that's been taking up most of my time alongside work, obviously, which we all have to do, don't we?
Oh yes, absolutely. Yeah. Yes, it's unfortunately work does take up an enormous amount of time, but you know, that's life, isn't it? But
yeah, necessary.
It's nice to be able to fit some gaming in here
it
and
is,
there.
Yeah. So moving on to site news. Now, you touched upon it a minute ago, Damien. So I'm going to leave this one for you.
I did. Well, as I did touch upon, we are doing an entire redesign of the Retro Asylum site. Essentially, what we started off with when Andy and I sort of pieced the site together, God, over a year ago now, we sort of just chose a default theme and sort of pushed it together as quickly as we could, just because we wanted to get something online and going and gauge interest in this. Now, obviously, since it's been a fantastic 2012 for Retro Asylum, we've really grown. We've got many, many, many members now, and lots of really, really good iTunes reviews. Please keep doing them. If you haven't done a review, do a 5-star review. We really appreciate it. But we've got the stage now where we really wanted to give the site a complete facelift. So I've spent the last probably a couple of months or so, it sounds like a long time, I've been fitting it around work, but I'm working on a complete WordPress theme redesign for the site, which is going to completely transform what the site looks like, and it's going to make it look a lot more, give it sort of a lot more retro looking feel, and it's going to really feel like Retro Asylum's come home. It's not a generic WordPress theme, it's something that we've done particularly specifically for the site, so it should look really, really good, I hope.
Brilliant stuff. Yeah, looking forward to that. Like I said, I've seen some of that already, and you're doing a fantastic job. It does look, just to give everyone a bit of a teaser, you know, like a cover of a magazine, an old magazine. While, you mean, you say it's like Retro Asylum's coming home to the retro look, it still looks quite modern at the same time, which I think is the beauty of it there. So there's a lot of modern influence as well as old school influence, which is really nice.
Yeah, I've tried to do a bit of both. I mean, we've got the old magazine covers, but I've tried to use some of the sort of new nice effects you can get with web development now. And so it should have a nice mixture of both. And so we're really looking forward to releasing this, because I think it's going to give us a great start to 2013. And of course, we're going to grow this show into something absolutely huge.
Brilliant stuff. Brilliant stuff. So that's a big bit of site news. I think that's going to be coming very shortly in the future. Big news, of course, is Andy, our fair leader, has had a baby, or his good lady has had a baby just the other day. Healthy and happy and all back at home now. So that's wonderful news. Congratulations to Andy. And in general news, I'm going to go over a couple of pieces, and I'm going to start off with an open source gaming handheld. Now, I mentioned the Arcos gamepad, which wasn't open source. I think there's a lot of people out there, and I'm one of them, that's looking for a device that plays old games through emulation, obviously, on a nice handheld device. I've had a GP2X Wiz, which was great, but like I said to Damien before the show, the emulation scene sort of didn't mature very well on it. There was a big hit of emulators come to it. Everyone, you know, converted their code from MAME for All and UAE for All and PSX for All and all these other wonderful emulators onto the GP2X platform, and then that was it. There was no further iteration to them, so you kind of stuck with the bugs and the quirks around this sort of underdeveloped code and emulators that weren't really that great. It was an alright machine. The screen was too small on it, but it was an alright machine. I enjoyed it. I sold it on. This one is called GCW Zero. It's being funded through Kickstarter, the wonderful Kickstarter, which so much seems to be funded through these days. And they're calling it the open source gaming console built by gamers for gamers. Now, the promotional video is very nice. It certainly looks the business. The D-pad looks nice, which is quite important with the kind of games everyone wants to play on emulation. And there's a big open source scene around the type of games you can get. And on Kickstarter, you can pledge, the minimum pledge to actually get one of the devices, $135, which to you UK folk out there is about £85. It looks good. It does look good. At the moment, with 14 days to go, they're about a third of the way to their goal, which is not looking too hopeful. So I think if you're into sort of an open source gaming handheld and want to emulate a lot of old platforms, get onto Kickstarter and look for GCW Zero, because this is something that could be really good, but without that funding, I'm not sure it's going to really surface too well. There are some units out there in the wild, not seeing them, not seeing that there's any reviews on them yet, but I think it's one to watch out for, and I'm quite excited about that one.
Yeah, definitely. I think anything like that is really, really interesting, because although a lot of us are going to have things like iPads and Nintendo DSs, all of which can be cracked and hacked, but generally it's very hard to sort of get emulation on those sort of devices without, you know, completely reinstalling the operating system. So it's very, very good to see someone with a completely open source approach, which is the system's completely wide open. You do whatever you want. There's no big corporate company trying to cut in and stop you from just enjoying yourself on these machines. So I really hope it does succeed. And yeah, okay, it's only a third of the way there now, but I seem to remember from Veterans to Billions, which I was following very closely up until its closing date, was actually quite a lot shy of it, of its target, right up until really the end, and then suddenly a huge surge came in and they cleared it. So let's hope that this does the same thing.
Yeah, well, Elite Dangerous did much the same thing. I was watching that on the last day, and it went from, or certainly the day before, went from 900,000 up to nearly 1.6 million in 24 hours, which was just fantastic. So I think you're right there. I think it's the same with everything in this world. We all wait until the last minute to buy things. We're never prepared, are we, as human beings? We're very underprepared. And I think Kickstarter, it probably given them a, you know, everyone who does stuff on the Kickstarter probably gets a heart attack a few days before, because they're waiting for their money and it doesn't always come through. But anyway, you mentioned in there about iPads and so on that can emulate. I actually jailbroke my iPad, and it really, the SNES emulator on it is absolutely brilliant, and so is MAME for All on it. It's absolutely wonderful, and hooking it up with either the iCade or the Wiimote, really, really nice. Great emulation device, actually. But again, they're not really developing the emulator as much on it, which is a shame.
I think it's a bit tricky, because I think the whole jailbreaking scene's been going through a bit of a difficult time, because I think I read not too long ago that they were struggling to crack iOS 6. I don't know that's whether they're actually struggling because of technical lack of ability. I don't think that's the case at all. I think it may be that they're just getting a bit bored with it now. Mm. This doesn't seem to be quite the same push to crack the Apple devices there were. And it might just be that there's a move away now that the Android devices are beginning to gather much more pace, I think. You're almost getting to the stage where Android tablets are becoming quite an attractive alternative. And for a while out there, it was only the iPad, really, that was any good.
It was. I used the Nexus 7, the Google Nexus 7. I must admit, it was one of the best Android tablets I've used. I've used quite a few through work, and they're all, I don't know, they all feel a bit of a compromise to me. And Hands up, I'm a bit of an Apple fanboy, but I'm open-minded enough to know when something's good, and the Nexus 7 feels nice. It doesn't feel like a compromise, both in terms of hardware and in terms of the Android version on it. A lot of devices were Android 4 and Ice Cream and Jelly Bean, but that just felt really slick, really complete, and it just felt like a complete package to me. So I think they're coming out. I think you're right there.
Yeah, I mean, I've had a very similar experience. I use a PC predominantly, but I do like my Apple mobile devices. I have an iPhone and I've got an iPad, and I think really for years there's been nothing like an Apple user experience, and despite all the restrictions they put on it and so on and so forth, the actual, when it gets down to it, you actually use iOS, and the actual, the way it works, all the gestures, it just all blends together so nicely, which we've got various work phones and stuff which have been based around Android, and I've tried a few of them, and they, as you say, Matt, they just haven't quite got it right, which I'm quite surprised by, because I would have thought that you're going to look at the Apple system and see how to imitate it, but maybe they've got a load of patents that you can't copy, but I don't think that's quite the case. So I've seen a lot of gesture controls are very similar to Apple ones. They haven't sued them, so I'm guessing that possibly it's just they just haven't quite got it together yet, but maybe they're doing that now.
Well, the Android market just seems a bit sort of segmented, really. There was just too many implementations of it. I think when Honeycomb came in at 3, that was the first tablet only one, and then the mobiles were stuck on 2.3 for ages, and I don't know, it feels like it's coming together now, which is good. I think competition is good, it's healthy, and it pushes the market on as well. You know, Apple, they've got a little bit stagnant. iOS, to me, I love iOS. It looks a bit old now. It feels the same as it did right back in, 2007 when the first iPhone came out?
Yeah, that's right. The other slightly sort of change in move, I think, post Steve Jobs with Apple, is that they've suddenly now sort of started, a bit like Samsung actually, they started releasing devices incredibly quickly, and I'm not sure if that's actually going to harm them.
Yeah.
Because before, they used to release devices quite slowly, but always with the release you've got a lot of sort of new features, and I'm not so sure. I think they're releasing hardware at such a fast rate now that almost can't quite keep the software up with it.
No, I agree with you there. They need another wow product. For me, they've just sort of, they've stagnated a bit. Still great hardware. I mean, MacBooks and MacBook Airs, the actual hardware, if you take away the whole Apple thing from it, because I know there's a lot of Apple haters and dislikers out there, take away the whole Apple thing from it, it's a beautiful device. It's a well-machined device. There's very few laptops that would match up to the build quality of a MacBook. I know Samsung certainly would, but there's very few others that would. But yeah, like you said, they're just releasing, it's kind of an iteration cycle they're going through now, rather than a revolution, which was the case. You know, the iPhone changed the face of phones, whether you like that or not. As a consumer, that's what's generated all the touchscreen devices we've got nowadays. Anyway,
absolutely.
I think we're digressing a little bit off. This will turn into an Apple slagging match if we're not careful. So.
I've got a little bit of general news I want to talk about, which is the CPC Wiki, which is the big Amstrad site. I'm a member of it. I suspect one or two of you are a member of this site as well. Well, a few of the guys on there have got together, and they're actually holding a 16 kilobyte game competition. And if any of you can program in Z80 assembly language, and even better if you can program the Amstrad CPC, they're asking you if you would like to make a computer game in 16 kilobytes or less in pure assembly language and enter it into their competition. Now, the rules I'll just go through very briefly. I mean, the most important one is the competition deadline, which is actually midnight GMT, just in case you're abroad, on the 1st of July this year. So you've got about 6 or 7 months to get that in. And all the submitted games have to work on all CPC models, and they can be no more, as I said earlier, than 16 kilobytes. You are allowed to compress the stuff, and it's encouraged because that shows a bit of programming prowess. And you're allowed to choose your favorite language. Oh, actually, I think I got this wrong. I said it's going to have to be assembly language. It looks like you're actually free to choose your favorite language. So I guess you could do it in Amstrad Basic. I probably wouldn't recommend it, but I think you can. But they have to be, the games have to be your own work. So things like a game hack won't be accepted, so don't go and hack an existing game and change the graphics. You ain't going to win. You probably get disqualified. And you can enter as many times as you like, and it's open to everyone in the CPC community, or indeed, you know, anyone that fancies having a go. So there you go. You can find out the details from the CPC Wiki. What we'll do is we'll post a link to it In the info section for this podcast as well, so you can go straight there.
Definitely, and it does make me laugh. 16k in this day and age is just not even a figure that you would associate with computers, is it? It's just so small. I mean, what in the modern computing terms would fit into 16k? Not even a raw text file, even a Word letter to, you know, a complaint letter to Sky telling them you hate their service. That's going to be a load more than 16k, isn't it?
Oh yeah, I mean, 16k is in modern terms virtually nothing. You're talking about a very small PNG file, or, you know, maybe a moderately sized JPEG with no color information or compressed almightily. I mean, it really is nothing at all. But actually, you know, back in the day, 16k was an enormous amount of memory. If you think the ZX81 had 1 kilobyte, yeah, well, there you go.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. And it's not to people of nowadays, 16k doesn't even comprehend on their radar, really. There's also, just to follow on from that 16k competition, RGCD, Commodore site, preliminary Commodore site, but they do talk about indie game development, often hold 16k cartridge competitions for the Commodore 64. And they get some fantastic entries. One that caught my attention at the Play Expo was a game called Super Bread Box, which was a conversion of a game called Super Crate Box, which is available on the iOS, Android, and also PC. It's a fun little one-screen shooter. And you've got to check it out. If you've got a PC or an Android and iOS device, have a look for Super Crate Box. But there's a 16K sort of remix of this on the Commodore 64, which come in at first place in this 16K competition. And I believe it will be released on cartridge very soon through RGCD. Really, really good stuff.
I look forward to seeing that. Absolutely. And actually, the whole homebrew scene is actually very, very interesting. I think Andy might have mentioned this in the past, but if you check out stuff that's still being made for the Atari 2600, for example, someone's just converted Halo onto the 2600. Obviously, it doesn't quite look like the Xbox version, but it's well worth checking out to have a quick peek.
Yeah, and I believe Castlevania is just coming out as well on the 2600. So
I think you're right.
Yeah, it's mad. It's mad, but it's also really, really heartening, and it shows that we're not willing to let go of these old platforms just yet, I don't think. But so I think moving on to the main topic now, I'm going to give a bit of a health warning now, and you might have noticed already that me and Damon are getting a little bit techie into things here, and we may go a little bit techie into the specs of the machines and how it works a little bit too much. Please don't turn off. Hang with us. We're going to try and keep it on a decent enough level, so we'll get some enjoyment out of this. The two platforms we've chosen for this is the Acorn Archimedes, which was obviously a computer, and the PC Engine, which was by NEC, if I'm right.
That's absolutely right.
Yeah, brilliant stuff. So, start off with the Archimedes. And Damien owns one of these and has owned one of these. I used one in the old school days, and I've got a real soft spot for the machine.
Acorn has set the standard for educational computing, supplying virtually every school in Britain. Now it introduces the next generation of educational computers, the BBC A3000. BBC computers are now regarded as an indispensable resource in schools, covering all subjects in the national curriculum. Our children need powerful tools to face the challenge of the future, and the BBC A3000 will be playing a key role in their education. Give your children a head start. By having a BBC A3000 computer in your own home, they will build on the solid foundation of the school's teaching and let their imaginations run free. But this is more than a classroom computer. The whole family can take advantage of its power and flexibility. It's easy to use, even for the youngest and newest of users. Everyone will use the word processor. You will have the confidence to change your mind as often as you like, improving text, checking spelling, and putting your thoughts into letters, essays, and documents precisely as you wish. The advanced technical features of the BBC A3000, which make it the fastest machine in its class in the world, also mean it's ideal for many business applications. And the PC emulator will allow you to run your office programs at home. And after hours, the BBC A3000 will be there when the family relaxes, whether the mood is for spectacular games or a quiet spell of creative harmony at the keyboard. Entertainment, business, and your children's education and future. all with the advanced BBC A3000 home computer. The learning curve.
Damien, if you can tell us a little bit about this machine.
Well, you're absolutely right about people using it at school. Is basically Archimedes was a series of computer systems. It was the successor to the BBC Micro, so the BBC Model B, the Model A, and the Master, and all those ones, which you would have seen in schools. Well, this was what came next, and it was also the first machine that actually had a RISC processor at its core. When Acorn developed the RISC processors, it did originally go into the BBC Model B as a sort of side processor, a bit like the Z80 could do as well. But the Archimedes was the first one that could actually use a RISC processor as its main system. So from that perspective, it was utterly unique. And of course, the RISC processing architecture known as ARM is now seen itself in all the modern day mobile phones. In fact, Windows 8 has just been compiled to run on it. So RISC is still very, 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 you know, important even today. And so if you want to see where it all began, an Acorn Archimedes is a place to come.
Absolutely. I think we might want to just explain what RISC is. So RISC stands for Reduced Instruction Set Computing, and this is essentially what it says. There's less instructions for the CPU to process, thus making it faster. The traditional, say the 68,000 processor on an Amiga or ST was a CISC chip, which was Complex Instruction Set Computing, if I'm right there.
That's absolutely right. Yeah, I mean, it's a simplification. It means that sometimes when you're actually the programming, it's weird because you would think it's harder to program. It's actually a little bit easier to program for these. You don't have to remember such an enormous instruction set. And even when I'm using Z80 assembly, there's so many instructions, it's quite hard to remember what they all do. With RISC, you might spend a little bit more time writing little routines, but you have to write them in little building blocks, and so you break something down into really simple components and work out how it works. And it's a nice way to work. And as Matt says, RISC processors did run a lot faster. And as a comparison, the Archimedes, the base model, which is the A3000, which is one that I've actually got, was roughly equivalent to Amiga 1200 in terms of where they sat in the market. I think the Archimedes might have been a tiny bit more expensive, but that's an aside, really. But essentially, the RISC processor in the Archimedes was commonly thought to be about 4 to 5 times faster than the Amiga 68,000. So it's quite a significant difference there.
Definitely. And was it a 32-bit CPU?
It was a 32-bit CPU.
Which is, that was very early in the world of CPUs to be 32-bit. So, yeah, like Damien said, the A3000 was released in 89, and I think the A3010 and the A3020 were released in 92, which the 3020 was for educational markets, and that's where it really found its feet. That's where I used it and got used to it as a machine. And what was the 3010? What was the idea behind that one?
Well, the 3010 was actually it was released for the educational market. Actually, where it differed from the 3000, I think it'd probably be a bit more accurate to say the 3000 is predominantly the educational one. And that's because if you look at the style of the two machines next to each other, the 3000 is a lot more sort of, it's a bit square, it's a bit more businesslike. Now the A3010, that's got smoother edges. It looks it's a bit more attractive. It's got green keys along the top instead of the BBC B's red keys, which the A3000 had. And it looks a bit cooler. You'll have to drag out some images on the web to see for yourselves, but it looks nicer. And I think it's a slightly fast machine as well, only by a little bit, but it is a little bit better. And it ran the latest version of RISC OS as well, so the UI was a little bit more updated. It's kind of a bit like going, I suppose, from the Amiga 500 to Amiga 1200. You got the new workbench, and it was all a little bit of an evolution, really.
Yeah, so essentially these machines, if you've never seen them before, look very much similar sort of profile to an ST or an Amiga. I think that's probably where they got the idea of packaging it from to make it more attractive to that market, maybe. I would guess that's the case.
Yeah, I think the 3010 was definitely Acorn's attempt to try and get it into the home as well as the school. The problem with it is it was quite expensive, and the way they were trying to get, you could tell they're trying to get into the home because the A3000 only has RGB output, whereas the A3010, I believe, has an RF modulator as well. So obviously you can immediately plug it into the TV set, which is very important for getting home use.
Absolutely, yeah. So again, like I say, I used one at school. I think we did a bit of programming on it, but in the spare time, obviously we played games on it. And we'll come on to the games in a minute. Just a little fact that the A3000 was the last ever machine that the BBC ever made. Not sure whether that's true or not, but it certainly seems
Like no, I can tell you right now. No, it's the last one to actually have the BBC Owl logo on it. If I look at my machine right now, I can tell you that it is the last one. And the A3010 completely did away with that. And I think that really marked the stage at which the BBC and Acorn parted company, really. Mm. And that was the end of an era.
Let's talk about what made it better or indeed worse than its competitors. And when you're talking about competitors, where do we look for this? Because it was preliminary an education machine, but I assume the ST and Amiga were probably its closest competitors with games.
Well, definitely. I mean, when the 3010 came out, as we touched on just now, it was designed to look a lot more like a nice sort of desktop computer. I mean, sort of a home computer much more. So it was styled in a much more attractive way to attract school kids that wanted to take them home and sort of bring them out of the school almost. So they were definitely looking to crack that ST and Amiga market. And so where it was better was, as we've already talked about, is its RISC processor that was, you know, 4 to 5 times faster than the Amiga and the ST. So that was a real strength. Where it wasn't as good was the graphics hardware. And this is where it's a little bit of a grey area because, of course, you know, its graphics hardware, it wasn't that sophisticated. It didn't have all the Amiga's co-processors and stuff. But because of the power of that RISC processor, it actually could do a lot of work in software. And that meant that you could almost get Amiga-like game conversions without all that hardware simply because it had the fast processor. So if you were to line up the Atari ST, the Archimedes and the Amiga, you would put it in that order. So Atari ST probably at the bottom, you know, slightly faster processor than the Amiga, but graphics hardware, it had a fairly basic blitter and that was it. The Archimedes, again, had a fairly basic blitter, but it had one hardware sprite, which it only really used for the pointer. But the great thing about it is it had that very fast RISC processor, and that allowed it to do in software a lot of the graphic effects you could do on the Amiga. And when we talk about the games, we'll be able to touch on that a little bit about how the conversions looked on the Archimedes when compared to their Amiga versions.
Sure. Am I right in saying that the 3D was quicker, or, you know, a 3D game, for instance, would be quicker on the Archimedes because the CPU was doing more of the processing and it was quicker as a whole?
Definitely. I mean, this is almost for any of you that owned a PC in the sort of Wolfenstein and Doom era. Well, as you all know, that the PC had a pretty rubbish graphics card. A VGA graphics card was very, very basic indeed. Yet it could run fantastic 3D games like Wolfenstein and Doom. And in fact, the same is very true of the Archimedes because it had the faster processing grunt like the PC had. It, for doing 3D, you don't need the special sort of copper effects of the Amiga doing these very smooth gradients and stuff, completely irrelevant in the 3D world. You were basically colouring in, you know, single colour shapes, maybe with a little bit of shading, but that processor, boy, could it throw things around.
Yeah, I think there was a bit of a battle. I think one person at school had an Archimedes and he was just constantly saying, well, your Amiga isn't as fast as mine. Well, you know, in reality, like we've spoken about, with its co-processors on the Amiga, it probably... I don't know whether it was comparable. There's probably some stat out there that says, you know, the Amiga was nearly as powerful as the Archimedes because of its co-processors. But, you know, when you own a machine and you love a machine, you zone in on one particular area where it's better than the others. You know, and I think we've got it in these days with Apple and Android being the sort of two most like-for-like, that there's a lot of love for Apple, there's a lot of love for Android, and you hone in on what's so good about it and forget about the bad parts of it, don't you? So,
yeah, I think that's very true. But, I mean... I think when you compare the machines, Amiga definitely had the edge. It had all the hardware sprites, had the hardware scrolling. Okay, the Archimedes could do that in software, but there are actually certain things an Archimedes couldn't do that Amiga could. And the Amiga is probably one of the best games machines ever made for 2D games, really is, and still stands up very nicely today.
Definitely, definitely. So let's talk about more exclusive games to the Archimedes. The reason why you'd want to buy an Archimedes, what was there any exclusive games for it that were any good?
Well, there was quite a lot of sort of educational games, of course, which are only really any good if you want to be at school. And so that was really its exclusive games market. But having said that, there are a couple of games which started out on the Archimedes. And the one that I really springs to my mind is David Braben's Zart, which became Virus on the Amiga. But again, because the Archimedes had that processing grunt, it's a much nicer experience than the Archimedes. And really, if you want to try out a really good Archimedes game, have a go on Zart. It's absolutely brilliant.
Yeah. Yeah, now, I played that. That was one of the first games I played on the Archimedes, and it impressed with its smoothness, definitely. And that was the wow factor, almost, was that game.
Yeah, and another game which I was very fond of from the BBC Micro was a game with a featuring a little terrapin called Repton. I don't know if you ever played that, Matt.
Yes.
Well, that actually did have a conversion onto the Archimedes, which was they updated the graphics a bit. It didn't look absolutely brilliant, but the fact is, it was the only platform you could actually get that version of Repton on. So that's a little bit of an exclusive as well. So if you're a diehard BBC fan of Repton, you could get Repton 300 Commodore 64, but that's where it stopped. The Archimedes is the only place you could come to.
Yeah, I see. And there was, like you mentioned to me the other day, Chrysalis did a lot of the conversions from the Amiga over to the Archimedes. They actually did some games on the Amiga as well. And I remember playing, was it Manchester United Europe come out on the Archimedes? Right. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Chrysalis did pretty much all the good Amiga games. You had classics such as Gods, RoboCod, James Bond 2, Chuck Rock, and Flashback as well. They all made it onto the system. And when I view the Archimedes software library, I really see it as a pick of the best titles on the ST and the Amiga, which really, you know, had a smaller software library, but yeah, it's no good having a big software library if most of the games are rubbish. And I think a lot of the games were rubbish on the ST and the Amiga. And I think having that refined software library in Archimedes, they just took the pick of the best and made some very, very good conversions.
And I think it also, you know, highlights having that smaller game collection also means you're going to play games a little bit more and not get bogged down in the latest game, the latest copy you've got off a friend, or, you know, bugging your parents for a new game. You want to get really involved in a game, don't you?
Absolutely. And the other unusual aspect of the Archimedes when compared to the ST and the Amiga is most of the ST and Amiga games were joystick only, because it was built to be a sort of, it was a home computer, but it was really an arcade game machine as well. On the Archimedes, I think, I don't know of any game that cannot be played on the keyboard. And that's really harking back to the days of BBC Micro, where all games could be played on the keyboard. I'm not too sure why, possibly because joysticks weren't really allowed at school because they were supposed to be educational machines. Yeah. But hey, we can sneak a game out and get it into a school somehow, because if you could play on the keyboard, that's brilliant.
Yeah, I think that was very similar in the 8-bit days as well. I mean, with the Spectrum, I noticed that majority of games you would play on keys. I don't know whether it was because my parents couldn't afford a joystick or whatever, but when I got my Commodore 64, to play on keys was quite a weird experience. So it's almost that same kind of thing again. Like you say, the ST and Amiga was very joystick driven, whereas the Archimedes was built around the keyboard. Maybe it was so we could all skive off lessons and play games in when we shouldn't be playing games at school.
I think that could be very true. Just sit in the corner and run up a game, and then when the teacher turns around, you quickly flick it over. Yeah, I'm sure that happened.
So Zarch is probably one of its what wasn't it bundled with the machine as well?
I'm not sure about that. It may well have been. That's something I don't know. I have to confess, I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah, I think it was. So that was obviously the yardstick for everyone to go on after that. What of the Amiga conversions to you was one of the best ones? Like I say, I remember Manchester United Europe, and I wasn't a big fan of the Amiga game. I just remember it being very good on the Archimedes.
For me, actually, I think Gods is a very, very good conversion indeed, as is Chuck Rock. I was actually playing both these just the other day, and really, Gods, and this is where we can sort of talk about the Atari ST's sort of lack of, I suppose, capabilities when compared to Amiga and the Archimedes, is the Atari ST had a much smaller screen, and it just is a little bit jerkier. It's not as nice. It's got less colours. And the Archimedes pretty much matches the Amiga visually 100%. The only thing missing is the it's a nice gradient skies, which, of course, the Amiga can do with its copper coprocessor. The Archimedes doesn't have one of those, so it can't exploit all of its 4096 colours. So you're locked out to 256 colours, and that's it. To make it worse for the Archimedes as well, is actually only, due to the way the hardware works, about only 16 to 256 colours available can be precisely chosen in the palette. All the others sort of system-driven. So you're a little bit restricted with your colour choice, but I tell you what, look at the conversion. It looks near enough identical.
Well, I think with sort of 240 other colours, you're going to get a fair selection of different colours to make your games in, aren't you? But, you know, you're talking about Gods, the bitmaps had a certain style about them. I'm not a big fan of Gods as a game, but it's a very classy game. It was never the smoothest of games, so that's maybe why it converted well, and why I can probably laugh at the ST a little bit more for not making that conversion too good. So I would have personally, I'd expected even on the Amiga that to be 50 frames a second, but it wasn't. It was somewhere around 25. I don't even know whether it is that good. So from what you're saying, the Archimedes was on a par with the Amiga version. I played Chuck Rock at a vintage computer fair, actually, on the Archimedes, and that really brought me back to the Archimedes. I thought, I really want one of these again, and that Archimedes I was playing on had an SD card solution in it as well, and it really, really whetted my appetite for one again. We'll come on to the SD card solution in a minute and so on. So So for games, it feels like it's an okay machine, nothing outstanding. Would we really want to buy it over an ST on Amiga? So I have this soft spot for the Archimedes. I don't know why. I like it as a machine. Maybe it's because it never really had that opinionated playground battle, should we say, like the Amiga and the ST had, or you know, likewise the Mega Drive and the SNES. Maybe it's because it was the rank outsider, but a friendly rank outsider, that is why it appeals to me now. And when I've got an Amiga and I've got Amiga emulation, what is it that's going to draw me to the Archimedes? I don't know what it is that's drawing it. What keeps you looking and playing at the Archimedes over an Amiga? Probably because you haven't got an Amiga, but
well, I mean, I do have an Amiga 1200 and stuff, which I absolutely love to bits. And
best computer ever made, Damien.
I think I have to agree with you. It's one of the it's the second computer I ever owned, and to be honest, it's probably the one that I remember the most favourably, because it's just such an amazing machine. It really is. You can't emphasise that enough. But really, for what drives my interest in the Archimedes is really down to the RISC architecture of it. And this was really the first time this was ever presented. And this is a technology that's still alive today. And I think for anyone that wants to mess around with a bit of assembly language programming, it's a really good place to look, because it's just interesting to see where it started. And it's a really good way to investigate it, because nowadays, the ARM RISC chipset has found its way into all sorts of mobile devices. These are quite complex devices, really, in comparison, whereas the Archimedes gives you a nice, a much more basic environment to mess around in. I think in that way it can be very rewarding.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds quite good, but surely having lesser commands to do things, you have to be a little bit more creative with the way you're writing stuff. To me, in my simple mind of not really knowing assembly language, because it's always baffled me, you know, the thought of having less instructions to do something means you're going to have to write a longer routine to achieve what you want. Thus, it kind of offsets its advantage straight away.
Well, I think the great thing about it is it actually makes you really think about what you're doing. And in fact, I get the same experience when I'm writing stuff on the CPC. And if any of you want to enter this game competition, you'll probably relish that same experience as well. With these machines, because you don't have the same suite of commands with the CPC, it's because you don't have the sophisticated Commodore 64 style hardware scrolling and stuff. So that makes your program a lot harder. You have to write all that in software, but the feeling of achieving something really, really cool with no hardware help is absolutely amazing. And the same thing for RISC, really. You achieve something really cool with a reduced set of instructions, but actually once you've written your sort of hardcore routines, you don't ever have to write them again. You write them once, and also you may well be able to write them better than you could do with all the complex instructions anyway.
Yeah, I guess you're looking at the fact it's optimized straight off, isn't it, because it's got that reduced instruction set.
Yeah, it's just all sorts of architectural things that can make a RISC chip very, very fast indeed. And at the end of the day, it's a choice as to what you like to use. And I think if you want to, if you don't know anything about it, if you've done other assembly language, or you just want to have a go, I think it's a really good system to have a look at, because it's generally interesting. It has a big footnote in computing history.
Definitely. So there, I know for certain there's an SD card reader solution available for it. It's probably around about the £40 mark, I would assume, much like the Amiga and the Commodore 64 and so on. Is there anything else that makes it easier for us coming to it nowadays as a hardware machine that you know of, Damien?
Well, I think, as you say, definitely the SD card solution does. But actually, the historic thing that makes it easier than messing around, I mean, setting up an SD card Amiga is okay, but you have to get WHD load and all this sort of stuff. With the Archimedes, because of the way it was designed, because it generally always connected up to a big hard disk system. It wasn't probably in the machine, but it was available. All the games, you can generally install them as simply as just dragging the icons across onto the hard drive, which is certainly something you couldn't do on many Amiga games. On most Amiga games, you pop it into a drive and workbench load, it wouldn't even be able to read a disk because of all the custom disk formats. But the Archimedes never really had that. And so that makes it a lot easier. Also, there's a wonderful utility called OmniFlop, which is a floppy drive. It's basically can make your PC floppy drive write all sorts of format disks. It's well worth checking out. And that, in today's age, getting games onto the Archimedes is very, very easy using the OmniFlop method.
Okay, that's interesting to know. Yeah. Brilliant. Okay, so I think what I'm hearing here, and from my own experience, is if you've got an Amiga or an ST, it's probably not worth you getting one if you just want to play games. But if you have a genuine interest in collecting other machines, it's very much a valid reason to get an Archimedes. There's plenty of solutions out there to make it relevant nowadays. I think it's more for the curious, isn't it, rather than for the fact that you want to play games on it.
Absolutely. Its games library, as we've touched upon, it is quite small, and there's nothing apart from the Zarch, perhaps, which did come out of the Amiga's virus, that you can't get on Amiga, pretty much. Apart from the educational games, which I'm suspecting the retromaniacs on this forum and site probably aren't that interested in. So, no, it really is a curiosity machine. I loved it. I was just very curious about the hardware and how it worked. If you've got that sort of curiosity, it's well worth checking out. If you just want a machine to game with, go and buy yourself a 1200.
Yeah, I'll say that over anything anyway, being a Amiga fanboy, but there we go. Okay, so that sums up the Archimedes nicely. So yeah, on to our next platform, which is the PC Engine, a console.
Exciting hobby machine, PC Engine, NECから発信.
Let's spend the night together, dear.
Ebony and I work together having fun.
PC Engine, do
you want to go? Please stop the cutting. You are
silly done. PC Engine,
do you want to go? Do you want to look at the bright side of your life?
It's you, Tanoshi. Look for it by CD-ROM Game Machine. PC Engine, do
preliminary come out in Japan, was trialed in some other foreign markets, but I don't think really got off the ground, to be honest. And it was a partnership between Hudson Soft, who produced a lot of console games in their time, and the hardware manufacturer NEC. The games, interestingly, come on a card type device, wasn't it, Damien?
Yes, yeah, a little something called a Hue card. It's a really, really cool little credit card size sort of card. I've never actually seen one physically properly until Replay Expo this year. I've seen pictures of them, you know, on the internet and stuff. But actually, when you hold one of these things, it's really aesthetic to behold that they've got all this stuff in such a tiny card. If you consider, we're talking sort of late 80s when this console came out, really quite amazing. And the whole console is beautifully made. It's regularly cited as one of the most beautiful consoles ever made. When you actually look and pick it up, and yeah, again, if you've never heard of this console, have a look on the web, but it's really small and really neat, and it looks a little bit futuristic. It's just absolutely brilliant. And I was actually reading the other day on the web, and I never really thought about this, but it was the first console that had CD-ROM games. And on the, I think certainly the white version of the console, maybe even on the grey one as well, but there's some little slots, horizontal slots going up the side, and they're actually designed to hold CDs, and it works. And even then, before they even released the CD-ROM, they thought of that, and I was just amazed.
Very nice, yeah. And I missed out on the opportunity of buying one recently. I was down in a retro game shop. It's called Burton-on-Sea down in Somerset. So if you're ever in that area, there's a great little retro computer shop there. And they had one, and it was only about £40, and it come with the game and boxed. And I missed out on it, and I'm quite gutted now. Looking at the prices on eBay, they go for a lot more than £40, and this was in fantastic position, but condition even. But yeah, the cards really, well, different. And like you say, this is the late 80s, when putting memory and chips onto a card, or into a card in this case, would have been quite hard, I would think, being so old.
Definitely. As an interesting aside to that, the PC Engine wasn't the only machine that actually used that card format. I actually found out on the web just last night that it was actually also used on the MSX computers as well. I don't know how widespread this was, but they had a picture of two cards next to each other, and they looked almost identical. So I don't know who took the idea from whom, but it was available on another platform.
I mean, if you look at it logically, though, if you think back to Commodore 64, 1982, with the cartridges, that cartridge board, the actual board that it was on, probably was only the size of one of these cards, maybe a little bit bigger. So, you know, if you think about it logically, it not quite as advanced as what you first think.
No, and the other thing is they could have been a lot smaller, but they actually made them larger so that, because the companies considered the game label to be the most important thing, and in actual fact the cards are bigger than they need to be, so the game label looks really nice.
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting point. I think if you look at life now, where everything's very digital, you miss out on that artwork. I'm a very avid record collector, being an old DJ, and just to have those covers is very, very important to me. And when you're DJing off a laptop or something, you don't have that ability to look through covers. And it's same with, you know, you buy stuff off iTunes. Does anyone really look at the covers? I don't think they do. And you don't browse by covers anymore. And I think what you're saying there with the artwork on these cards, very, very important, because you'd sift through a load of them in a computer shop and you're looking for the artwork for first and foremost if you don't know too much about the games.
Yeah, I mean, it's psychology, isn't it, at the end of the day? I mean, people are attracted to things that look beautiful. And if you've got, I mean, I remember that when I used to buy games on my Amstrad and on my Commodore 64, I'll go and look, and it'll always be the one with the more attractive artwork. And if they had screenshots on the back, even better, because obviously then you start selecting it via screenshot rather than the artwork. But if there's no screenshots, you go for the one with the amazing artwork nearly every time.
Yeah, you just can't really comprehend it these days, because we've got YouTube. For music buying, you've got clips all over the internet. You don't go into a shop now not really knowing what you want to buy and looking at screenshots and so on, whereas very much back then, like you say, it's basic psychology, is you're attracted to colourful things. You're attracted to, I mean, taking it right back, you're attracted to the basic colours, the primary colours. And I think that's the same throughout your lifespan. I love looking at covers and I love looking through things like that, but I would never go into a game shop now and just look at the screenshots on the back. That just doesn't even compute anymore, does it, really?
No, all that's gone away, because now, again, it's because the internet, I think, has really taken such a primary role in everyone's life, really, you know. Like it or not, it's really there. And yeah, when I go and buy a game, I'll either buy it online via Steam or something platform like that, or I might go and buy it from a shop. But certainly before I've done that, I would have read probably 10 reviews of it on IGN, etc., just to find out if it's any good. Certainly I don't go in and take a punt anymore, because I don't need to take that risk, because it's all online. And that's a little bit of a shame in a way, because sometimes you've got some really genuine surprises. Other times, of course, you've got some really horrible surprises. So maybe, you know, it's quite good.
I think they balance themselves out, don't they? You know, you've got a good genuine surprise and you get something quite bad. Do you know how much these games retailed for? I'm assuming it was around the 40, if it was converted to the UK, probably 40, 50 pounds maybe.
Yeah, it was around that mark. I mean, they did vary quite considerably, but generally, most of them commanded a reasonably high price point, simply because a lot of arcade conversions. They're sort of, we'll touch on that a bit more in a minute. But they were games that a lot of people wanted. So you release R-Type, you can quite happily sell it for quite a lot of money. And it's quite interesting, really. Over the years, game prices haven't really moved that much. They've always kept fairly sort of consistent with monetary values of the day. And they, you know, they're about £50 an Xbox game. So maybe they're a little bit cheaper, actually, if you take in relative terms, but actually they still feel like they cost the same sort of amount of money, certainly to me anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. So interesting little tidbit about the PC Engine. So it was released as a TurboGrafx in the US, we believe. In Japan, it was known as the PC Engine, but it was marketed originally as a 16-bit machine. However, the CPU was actually only 8-bit. But the graphics chips in it were 16-bit. So that was quite an interesting hybrid going on there. But I'm right in saying that they marketed it originally as 16-bit, and then it was shifted down to 8-bit. Is that right?
Well, yeah. Well, basically what happened is when it came out in Japan, it was set to go against the Nintendo machine, so the Famicom and the Super Famicom, or the SNES and the NES, as they were known over here, and also the Sega Mega Drive or Genesis. And of course, the PC Engine came out a little bit before the Genesis. I think it was about a couple of months or so, and they marketed it as this wonderfully new, exciting 16-bit machine. The Genesis then came out, and of course, the Genesis marketing guys had done some investigation, said, oh, hang on a minute, this has got an 8-bit CPU. So they then started mocking NEC for this. And I think eventually something must have happened, because they then had to start marketing it as a hybrid machine instead. They couldn't call it 16-bit anymore. I suspect someone went to some sort of advertising standards and complained, probably Sega.
Well, yeah, more than likely. It's probably one of the early legal battles that ensued in this world. From what I've seen of it, the games are, I don't know, it's strange, because I can't really define, and I think it really goes in with this hybrid sound to it, I can't define whether they're 8 or 16 bits. Sometimes I think the games look very NES-like, but sometimes, you know, in the respect of, say, R-Type, which is a fantastic arcade conversion, it's very much up there with the Mega Drives of this world. And it's really, it's almost at odds with itself in what era and what generation of machine it should be in. And I think, like you say, that was admitted in the end by marketing it as a hybrid machine.
Yeah, I think what probably happened is when it came out, because of the 16-8-bit elements, I think there was a bit of confusion over maybe even what its capabilities were. But certainly on the later titles that came out, games like Parasol Stars, for example, or Parodius, which we'll talk about a little bit in a minute, they really captured the power of the console. And you could have multiple parallax scrolling backgrounds, so you could get stuff that looked... Actually, the version of Parasol Stars is better than the Amiga version. If you think, you're talking about machines which in some ways are worlds apart, but actually in other ways are very close. But the PCN is actually a little bit better. It's got 8-channel sound for a start, which is quite different to what the Amiga could do, only 4-channel. And so, it's quite a difficult thing to try and work out where its games went. And you're absolutely right, Matt. Some of the earlier titles did look a bit NES-like. And I think a lot of that is down to the people who are doing the conversions and the people who are writing software. Some knew the games. I mean, Hudson themselves obviously released an enormous amount of titles. They always tend to be a bit better, whereas I think maybe some of the more third-party titles just weren't quite as good.
Definitely, and I agree with that. And just coming on to the sound, for me, I think I've aired this before on podcasts, I'm not a fan of the Mega Drive sound at all. I'm not a fan of FM Synthesis at all. It's got a very glassy, metallic quality to it, which works in some situations, and you can make it sound wonderful, of course. But for me, the Mega Drive was always quite weak. But in comparison, the arcades at the time were using FM chips as their sound chip. So what I was hearing back when I was in the arcades, thinking, wow, this sound was brilliant. When I'm listening back on MAME nowadays, I'm actually thinking, oh, it sounds actually quite weak. And I think with the PC Engine, the waveforms that it uses are very clean, very nice, not warm like the SID. The SID's got a very warm yet digital quality to it. This was just very straight and plain, but quite nice. I think it was Outrun I was playing on one of the emulators, and the music in Outrun, which I'll come onto in a bit, was almost like a remix of the original. It had these sort of chord harmonies going on, which wasn't in the original music. So I think sound wise for me, it is better than the Mega Drive, and like you say, it's got 6 or 8 channels. Just I think it's got a good solid sound to it, rather than being an amazing sounding chip. It's just a good solid chip, I think.
Well, I mean, you're absolutely right in your comparison with the SID chip. I mean, what it's missing is the analog filters on the SID chip. That's what really gives it its warm sound, and you just don't have that. It's a purely digital chip. I mean, the SID chip is unique at the time to have the analog filters, and even today, as I'm sure Matt, and I suspect other people who've tried to emulate a SID chip on the PC, well, we still haven't got the analog filters, so we still can't emulate a SID chip properly, and that's why I still get my Commodore 64 out right now.
Absolutely, yeah, it's got a lovely crusty quality to it. I love the sound from the SID, but we could go on that. That's a whole podcast right there, the SID chip. But yeah, I thought musically and sonically, a very solid machine, definitely better than the Mega Drive. While it had more channels than the Amiga, it was much more chip sounding than the Amiga. The Amiga was very sample based. Well, it was sample based. That was the basis of the sound chip. Whereas the PC Engine was preliminary chip sounding. Not necessarily a bad thing, but that has its limitations, certainly sometimes. So let's move on to what games were available for this machine. So I took some time to emulate some of the more classic arcade machines that everyone knows and loves and has probably got on 30 or 40 different platforms, if there was that many. And I found a lot of the classics were good, not amazing at times in terms of R-Type, very very good. But Afterburner 2 was the one I played. I really really liked that. I thought it was every bit as good as a Mega Drive or even the arcade version. I can't really see a huge amount of difference between the two. Chase HQ I was a little bit disappointed with. The engine sound was awful, to be honest. Wasn't very good. And the cornering, when you were cornering, all the graphics went a little bit jerky. As I mentioned before, Outrun, great rendition of the music, really, really like that. Strangely, there was no choice of direction at the each end of the stage. That was my main criticism with the Outrun conversion. I don't know whether you've noticed that, Damien.
Yeah, it is a little bit cut down. This is one of the things that you'll find on quite a few PC Engine conversions is some of them look very... I mean, R-Type's... I think R-Type came out on two cards in the US, but I think in Japan, if I remember this rightly, I think it only had the first four levels on it.
Right.
And so if you know the arcade very well, you might have been... you almost certainly would have been quite disappointed by that. But, yeah, I mean, Chase HQ is a really interesting one because, of course, it had a pretty rubbish conversion on... Well, it had a very bad conversion on both... on the Amiga in particular, yeah, which was an ST port, and yeah, it wasn't very good on any home computer system of the 8-bit series. I think maybe the Commodore 64 and the Spectrum were okay, but the Amstrad version certainly was a complete pile of rubbish.
I think the Commodore 64 was pretty bad as well. I think the Spectrum was probably the best of the 8-bits.
Yeah, I think so. And Chase HQ, I thought it's obviously got its problems and its limitations and stuff, but... the Amiga and ST conversion of that, again, is terrible. I didn't realise at the time, I thought it was okay, but then having run at the arcade in MAME, it's like there's nothing, there's no comparison.
Worlds
it's
apart.
So much worse.
But R-Type, like we said earlier, is a very, very good conversion. Lovely and smooth. And that's one thing I noticed about even the emulation is well, obviously I'm not comparing like for like here, but the emulation was very smooth as well. So I can only imagine on the real thing, very, very nice. So yeah, I mean that's a few sort of classic arcade conversions, and there was a lot of arcade conversions, and I would say from what I've seen and played, very, very solid conversions. Certainly if you owned a PC Engine at the time, I don't think you'd have been too shortchanged with a lot of them. We touched on R-Type not having quite as many levels. It had a lot of exclusives, didn't it, Damien? And I think we've decided that you need to be Japanese for a lot of these exclusives.
Yeah, we had a lot of trouble with it. Well, I had a lot of trouble with this because a lot of the exclusives are Japanese only sort of RPG games and stuff. And so without being able to read Japanese, unfortunately, I don't have any Japanese friends at the moment who can convert them. So I can't really tell you much about it. All I can say is if you're interested, do check it out. You can search it down, but what you will find is predominantly it was really had a lot of arcade game conversions. A lot of conversions appeared on other platforms too. Mm. Having said that, you know, quite a few games have appeared on the PC Engine first. I think actually Paracel Stars appeared on the PC Engine a little bit before the Amiga. So it has some exclusives maybe for a few weeks or so. Mm. Really, I mean, one game that actually wasn't exclusive that I can talk about is a little pretty unknown title called Military Madness. Now, any of you who used to play on Amigas and PCs around about probably 1992 to 94, somewhere around there, may remember a game called Dune 2, which was a real-time based strategy game based on the books by, and I can't remember who the author of Dune was, right? I can't remember his name. I have to look that up later. But if you remember, the game was basically about mining spice, and you had this sort of turn-by-turn strategy, and you had to mine your spice, you had to destroy the enemy troops. I think there are different houses. One was Harkonnen, and I struggled to remember the others. It's a long time since I played this game. But Military Madness, I was playing around with this the other night, and I've been reading a little bit about it, and it's generally been cited to be one of the key influences in the development of Dune 2. And actually, having played it, it reminded me a lot of Dune 2. And it's a really good game. It's well worth checking out. It's got some fantastic graphics in it. It's got some really absorbing sort of strategy elements, and it's good fun. It's sort of turn-based strategy, but with a very nice arcadey element, which is something that the PC Engine does very well.
Yeah, what I'm seeing on I'm just looking at a few screenshots here on the internet, and what I've just seen is clearly a cut scene of a battle going on between two troops, and that's exactly the same as Advance Wars on the Game Boy and DS. So there's certainly some influence come on later titles from this game. There's no doubt about that. And yeah, there's one particular screen I'm looking at now which is identical to Advance Wars. I don't know whether you've ever played that before, but it's a similar kind of game by the looks of it.
Yeah, I have played Advance Wars a long time ago, admittedly. But yeah, I mean, again, it's got a lot of... Certainly those cutscenes are very, very similar. And they're great, really, because you get your little men on the left, your little men on the right, and they come together, and it tells you how much power you've got at the bottom of the screen on both sides. And you can roughly guesstimate how many troops you're going to lose in that particular battle. And once you know, you go and fight them again if you until you wipe them all out, and then they disappear off the grid and you make your advancement forward. So really, really good game though. If you've liked Dune 2, if you like, you know, Advanced Warfields, then it's really one to check out.
Yeah, I think I will actually. Another type of game that seemed to be quite prevalent on the PC Engine was shoot 'em up games. There's a lot of shoot 'em ups on it, and some probably better than others. I think there's something for all there in terms of shooters, and there's one particular shooter which we want to talk about, and I think we've decided it's called Parodius. Is that correct?
Parodius or Parodius. Parodius. We're trying to work this out. The reason why I say it might be Parodius is because it's basically a parody of Gravitas, and so parody, it could be either way.
Is it Gradius as well? Gradius?
Gradius. Did I say that wrong? I think I meant Gradius.
Oh, Gradius, yes. Gradius.
It could be it's hard to if anyone actually knows how to pronounce this, maybe you can send us a record and we'll play it on another show or something.
We won't lose sleep over that one, I don't think. But this game was a parody of Gradius or Gradius, however we want to say it. Yeah, I mean, you told me about this one, Damien, and I think you're best placed to describe this one to the listeners.
It's one of my favourite games on the system. It's one that one of the first games I played on emulation. I basically just took a punt on it because I never played it before. I hadn't even played Gradius either. And gosh, it's a horizontal scrolling shooter with a difference. It is a parody, but in a big way. It's the sort of game that only the Japanese could make, and it's so weird in places it's brilliant. So essentially, it follows the same sort of R-type style horizontal shooter. So you move through your levels and you shoot a few things and you hit a guardian halfway through that you have to defeat, and then you hit another one at the end, you defeat that, move on to the next level. So far, so good. But this game, I mean, I can just talk briefly about the first level. It's a sort of level with lots of battleships and stuff. And I'm talking about sort of seafaring ships on water. So things like the Spanish Armada, I guess. So you've got lots of sort of ships the sort of big ships that come on the screen, complete with sails, and they come and attack you. What's different about it is, for some reason, I don't know why, is on the head of this ship, there's a cat's face. And whenever you shoot it, it squeals until it then blows up and goes black. Then you shoot a bit more, then it eventually falls off the screen. This is the sort of, you know, the madness that this game is. And as you move through the game, there's a section of levels that take place in a nightclub. And the guardian, the sort of the mid-stage guardian, is this sort of, I don't know, she's not a pole dancing woman, but she's a sort of woman that's sort of dancing horizontally across the screen, moving her legs in a timed fashion. What you have to do is you have to fly under one foot as it moves up, hang around from it, then fly out the other side, and basically the screen locks you into a certain position. So the screen starts scrolling and she just wanders up and down several times. You have to avoid her a little bit, then it slowly starts scrolling forward. So it's a real skill test, but also one of the most ridiculous scenes I think I've ever seen in a computer game. It's a great game. It did come out on the SNES, and it is available on the Virtual Console if you want to check it out on your Wii. But, you know, the PC Engine version is one that I played the most, and I think it's absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, I'd certainly seen this before you mentioned it, but after you mentioned it, I checked it out on YouTube, and it really is quite something to behold. It certainly doesn't take itself seriously. It's taking the mickey, plain and simple. I don't think anyone could have sued anyone for that game, because it's clearly done very, very tongue-in-cheek, but a great shooter, clearly, as well, which is fantastic. So, yes, there's not a lot more to talk about on the PC Engine, really. I think this is that we've picked very two similar type of platforms here, in that if you wanted to get one, you're probably getting it because you're quite intrigued by it, rather than you want one because it's got a certain killer app on it. Other than the exclusives, which we've touched on, which are mainly Japanese or quite shooter like I don't think there's too much there to worry about. I'm sure there's a lot of people saying yes, there's certain game that's brilliant on it, but it's an intriguing platform. It's something that you'd want today to collect it. I think the prices are staying fairly stable at the moment and may start creeping up at some point. The games are probably just going to get more and more expensive as time goes on. I don't think there's anything to say about that one. But why would you want one, Dan? Why would you want one over a Mega Drive, for instance?
Well, funny enough, I've just bought a Mega Drive, which is probably not. No, the particular reason I want one is we've touched obviously a lot on the cartridge based games, but actually this was, as we mentioned earlier, this was the first machine that had CD-ROM gaming capability. And the beauty of the CD-ROM gaming is that actually none of the games are actually protected, and it's quite easy to get hold of them now. Which obviously with cartridges, that there is an actual cost to them because they can't be reproduced. I mean, you can obviously get them for emulation, but CD-ROMs, you can get hold of the images for those reasonably easily off the internet. And so to actually get a CD version of the game, it gives you a chance of actually being able to play stuff that you probably just can't get hold of now. Not that we condone piracy at all, so you know, please don't take it that way. But the reason I mention it is some games just simply aren't available, and the platform is so old. I think it'd be an awful shame for people not to be able to experience this platform and how it was like and why it's so wonderful. I mean, these games aren't going to come up for sale. The software houses aren't going to start selling them, and I would imagine that, you know, you're probably not going to fall into much trouble. You know, obviously, don't try and sell them, but if you can get hold of them, which you can, and they're not copy protected, I think is a really good thing.
Yeah, and interestingly, something we didn't mention was that as standard, the PC Engine only comes with one joypad port, which might actually make it a little bit limiting, but there was an add-on for it, I believe, that gave you five player capabilities. Is that right?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Yeah, it was a bit weird that it only had, because a lot of the games that I've played definitely have, but when we play it under emulation, in fact, this is something that I didn't realize until the other day, only had one game port. This shows what happens when you play stuff under emulation all the time. You just take for granted that you can have five people playing. I mean, it's a bit difficult on a keyboard, admittedly, but yeah, you've got loads of USB ports, off you go, your joysticks. So yeah, it was really unusual in that, and I don't really know what the thinking was behind it, but there, you know, even the Amstrad that had only one joystick port, you could actually connect two joysticks together with a pass-through cable and have two. But with the PC Engine, you did, your only option was the add-on card.
Unsociable console, we should say, then, probably.
Yeah. To play on your own.
Absolutely. So that's the PC Engine. I certainly want one. I've missed up the opportunity to get one previously, and it's whetted my appetite to get another one. I've never played on one, you know, in person. I've never played on the real hardware. It's only been emulation, so I think I'm missing out on a nice little console here. Yeah, it's an intriguing console. I would, if I were you, I would look out for one, definitely. So that brings us to the end of our two platform topics there, and we're going to move on to a couple of other bits now. Music from the past. As I mentioned in the last podcast, we've got a forum thread going. Please get on there and mention some of your music from the past, where people have put in their favourite tunes for computer games. So, Damien, you're going to introduce the first one.
Yeah, the first piece of music we've got for you today is the intro for Wing Commander, which is a little bit of a... It's got some Star Wars elements, a little bit of a take of Star Wars. I think you'll enjoy it.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Excellent. And second up is Last V8, which is a Rob Hubbard classic on the Commodore 64. And if you're an Amiga Amiga bod as well, you might have noticed this was used in a number of Kraken screens. It was Kraken intros. So this is a Rob Hubbard classic, Last V8.
Finally, if you remember this week, I was saying I've been playing Trolley Wally, which doesn't have tracks exclusively written for the game, but there actually are remakes of Jean-Michel Jarre's Equinox, and this one is track 4.
Stuff. Thank you very much to Darren and Hoolicall for those two tracks there. Brilliant, brilliant selections. And of course, Damien with his Trolley Wally example. They're coming to the end of the podcast now. I just want to say, leave us some iTunes reviews. We like to read feedback on the show. And if you're not on the forum or you don't want to leave us a comment on the website, leave us an iTunes review. It's really what gives us the get up and go to carry on doing these shows, which we love to do, but we also like to know people are listening and feeding it back to us. Come along to the website, www.retroasylum.com. Leave us a comment. Come onto the forum if you really want to be brave and strong. And soon, a new website.
Yep, yep. I really hope you're going to like the new site. We, you know, absolutely love putting it together. Sweaty and I have spent a lot of time exchanging emails, getting stuff going. I think it's given him a sort of a welcome break from his second experience of fatherhood. So I think he's enjoying that. And I'm sure we're going to be seeing Andy and Sweeney back on the scene very, very shortly.
Absolutely. So we'll end it here now. The forthcoming podcast, quite exciting ones. We've got a couple of interviews coming up in the next month or so. But the next podcast will be out in a week's time. So hope you've enjoyed listening. It's Matt Denari saying goodbye. And Damien, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much too. See you all soon.
Take care now.
This is Retro Asylum, the UK's number one retro gaming podcast show.